the opportunity, giving me the opportunity to talk here. What I will be talking about is joint work with Marius Wencha from the AI and Mark Mars from Salamanca University. And I will be talking about the fingerprints of black holes. In particular, what is the information content of the shadow of black holes? Now, first, let me introduce you to my friend Bob. He's working for the Galactic Police, and he has a problem. Namely, some of his stars get stolen by night, and he suspects that one of the black holes that is living in his territory is actually the thief. So he's been thinking up how to capture it and how to take a picture. And now that is in the real life where the Event Horizon Telescope comes in. So for those of you who are not familiar with it, the Event Horizon Telescope is the attempt to actually picture the shadow of Sagittarius A star, so the supermassive black hole at the center of the Milky Way. Now, what it is a network of radio telescopes that work together with very long baseline interferometry. You can more or less act as if you have one big telescope that has the diameter of the planet. And that is necessary because the resolution they need to actually make a picture of the shadow is something like resolving an apple on the surface of the moon. So they need a very good resolution. And now this has been carried out last April. They collected the data and they hope to produce something. I think now the schedule, I was in Harvard last week and I talked to Shep Dolman. He said something like end of May, they hope to have converted the data. We'll see. I'm very excited. I hope to see the picture soon. Now, our friend Bob was a little quicker, so he managed to snap the picture of the black hole eating the star, but now he has to actually identify which one it is. And now here comes in my goal, what I want to tell you today. What I want to convince you is that in principle, an observer outside of the black hole can determine almost every physical parameter of the black hole he wants to know. So he can say how fast it's rotating, what is its charge, how far away from the black hole he is, and what is the relative position or the relative direction of the axis of rotation with respect to the observer. Now, and even more, he can determine how fast he's moving with respect to some standard observer. Now, what I'm talking here, of course, is when I say in principle, I'm not talking about a practical observer in the real world. What I'm talking is what do the equations allow us to extract at maximum? So this is a very mathematical result, but maybe someday we might get actually close to extracting this information. So what I'll be talking first, I'll go over the background a little bit, the foundations, introduce the notations that I'm going to use, and introduce the Kerr-Newman-Taub-Knott metrics on which we'll be working. And then I'll explain you how the formalism of the celestial sphere works and how to derive the shadow parametrization. Now, then I will go a little bit more in the mathematical directions where these ideas come from, just a little sidetrack, before I actually explain to you how the degeneracies of the shadow are defined and how to work with them and how to determine whether something is degenerate or not. Now, just real quick, here the Schwarzschild metric, just to set the notation. It's a spherically symmetric space-time with an event horizon at r equals 2m, that is asymptotically flat and static. So when we take it together in the Penrose diagram, we have scry plus, so this is null infinity. We have here scry minus, so this is kind of past null infinity. The green line represent t equals constant hypersurfaces. The red ones are r equals constant hypersurfaces. And here at r equals 2m, we have the event horizon. Now this is just, I will be using, what I'll be interested in really is the domain of outer communications. So the definition of black hole that I'm really using is just any event, any position in space-time that is not cannot send signals to Scribe Plus. And the domain I'm going to be interested in is the domain of outer communications, so basically this diamond here. So that is just for to set up the frame. Now, the metrics that we're looking at are the Kern Newman top nut metrics. And this is this mess, you don't really have to care about what it looks like. The important thing is they are all stationary and axisymmetric, and they're type D space times. This will come in, this will be important later. And we do have an event horizon at R plus, which is at the location of the zeros of the radial functions. Now, the important parameters here are essentially the mass m, the charge q, the spin parameter a. And then there are these two additional parameters, where it is the nut charge, nut parameter L, and the Mankiewicz parameter C. Now, with these two additional ones, just to be clear to start with, they give a lot of pathologies in the spacetime. So most people would consider them to be a priori unphysical, because you get weak singularity on the rotation axis. So you get like a conic singularity there. And therefore, people would rule it out. But the reason we look at it here is exactly because it introduces actually a degenerate case. So what we'll be arguing in the end is, even though most people consider it unphysical, just from an observation of the shadow itself, we cannot rule out this parameter. So I will consider it here. Yes?
Is there any known mechanism through which a star could decay or collapse into one of these objects?
I haven't even looked at it. I mean, it's wild, like when you read through the literature, it's wildly commented to be unphysical for various reasons. I mean, the weak singularity being one of the strongest reasons. But yeah, I guess also it'd probably be hard to have. Yeah.
Electrical charges also unphysical, because like astrophysical bodies do not have electrical charge, including black hole. It neutralizes instantly.
Yeah, but I mean, but you could in principle like have a little charge that wouldn't be weird, while
tiny bit of charge. Sun, the ratio of Coulomb to Newton is 10 to the 40. I've done it, it's very interesting. The sun blows up instantly.
Yeah, so I mean, okay, but still, I mean, with the charge, there's a different thing. The reason it's assumed that the astrophysical bodies are neutral because of this process, because
it's
approximately neutral. Yeah, anyway, but the L parameter really gives you a lot more weirdness, like you get all kind of stuff. And what is even weirder is with this Mankiewicz parameter, it doesn't really have much effect except that it modulates where the singularity is. So depending on how you choose it, you can either have a conical singularity just on the upper part of the rotation axis or just on the lower part, or you can have it on both parts. So this is kind of weird, and I don't really understand the details. But yeah, so it gives an interesting result in our context, what we're looking at, which is why we treat the parameter nevertheless. Now, as I mentioned, the spacetimes are type D. That is very important because that gives us four conserved quantities for every geodesic. So we have the mass, we have the energy and the angular momentum with respect to the rotation axis that come from the Killing vector fields. And then there is this additional conserved quantity, the Carter constant, which comes from the Killing tensor. Now, first, I want to introduce like the concept of trapping in the context of Schwarzschild, because there it is easier to see. So in Schwarzschild, we can do the same thing, but now we can constrain our motion to the equatorial plane, so we only have the LZ angular momentum and the energy, and the radial equation becomes very simple. So we get actually like a one-dimensional equation that we can look at, and we can see that for light-like curves, there is one stationary radius. So there's one radius where the null geodesics can stay fixed, and that is at r equals 3m, which is called the photon sphere. So there they just stay forever in this compact spatial region. Now, if we go to, so this concept of trapping is quite important, which is why I want to mention it here. Now, if we go to Kerr or Kerr-Newman-Taub knot, the geodesic equations look a lot less nice. The important thing you should take away from this is you can more or less like separate it in that form, and that for null geodesics, the radial potential and the theta potential are homogeneous in E. So there are really only two parameters that determine the global behavior of a null geodesic. So if you're interested in the global behavior, there are only two parameters, the value E over LZ over E and the Carter constant over E squared. Now, if we look at trapping in Kerr, we basically apply the same procedure as we did before. We take the radial potential and its derivative, set it zero, and this allows us to parameterize the trapped set in terms of the constants of motion. So when we have a trapped geodesic at a certain radius, then it has fixed Carter constant and a fixed LZ angular momentum. Now, if we plot this region now for Kerr, for a very high spinning Kerr, we see that the region of trapping here looks much more, it looks much different from Schwarzschild, where we just had a sphere. It is important, though, to note that every trapped null geodesic is always still remaining on a constant R sphere. So they are they're never moving around here, but like every trapped null geodesic stays at a fixed radius. Now I'll go on to explain the concept of the celestial sphere. So for every point in the manifold, if we pick a time-like observer, then we can write the tangent vector to a null geodesic in the following form. So we have our time-like observer and we have our orthonormal basis. And now we know, because this vector is supposed to be null, that the k has to be a unit vector. So now for every observer, the light cone has only an S2 degree of freedom. So if I have my laser here, I can only choose in which direction I will send it because everything else is basically fixed. So for the definition here, when I write gamma KUP, then I mean a null geodesic that goes through the point P and has tangent vector K at this position. Now, this allows us to define a number of sets here on the celestial sphere of an observer, namely the future infalling, the future escaping, and the future trapped set, and the past equivalences. So you don't really have to bother about the definitions here. Just look at the picture. It's pretty simple. So when we have a point P, we have some null geodesics that fall into the black hole, some that go out to infinity, and some that somehow remain in a compact region to the future, and vice versa to the past. So now if I define the shadow of the black hole, what I'm talking about mathematically is the union of the past infalling set and the past trapped set. So more or less what we do in our mental picture is we put light sources here at scry minus, and then we ask the question, okay, now if the observer looks in his sky, which directions are going to be dark? So,
what did you draw there, like going to I plus? That cannot be. It should be meeting I plus somewhere.
No.
The one in the middle. Because otherwise that would be part of your horizon.
No. These are the trapped ones. These are the future trapped ones. So you have in Schwarzschild.
But it could trap forever.
Yeah. That's the point.
Be able to see past that, and then it's part of the horizon.
No, I mean, these are, so in Schwarzschild, for example, these are the ones that will asymptote to 3M.
So, we're not talking about this, we're talking about the R1.
This one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if it never gets to like plus, does it ever get to like plus?
No. No. It never gets to scribe plus.
It falls into the singularity.
No. No.
Then it's a part of the horizon.
No.
I could be in the observer up there. I said, run now, race backwards, and it never gets to see inside the region.
No, you do. So this one is approaching 3M. But between 3M, between the photon sphere and the horizon, if you shoot out the laser from there, you're circling. Yeah, yeah. So that's exactly that. So the future trapped ones, they approach the photon sphere. So they will never go into the horizon, nor will they go out to infinity. And eventually these are exactly the ones that constitute the boundary of the shadow, essentially. So now the definition of the shadow as you have here, so you can think of that picture basically. When you shoot the penalty, so either it goes in or it doesn't, but now we count, if you hit the post, it counts as a goal as well. Now, here is, to mention the drawings before were made by a friend of mine, now this is my limited drawing skills, that is Bob again. So he has this S2 of directions where he can shoot his laser. Now, if there's a black hole in his neighborhood, basically what you can think of, there are the directions that end up in the black hole when he shoots his laser, and there are some that go to infinity. Now, as I said, in the real world, we look at the inverse. So we ask the question, okay, I place light sources out here at infinity, so I have all my stars in the universe, everything that lights up. And from which directions will there be light here? And now the point is, no matter how much light I place out here, the blue triangle here will always stay dark. So basically, if you go to the actual full scenario, you will always have a certain dark blob on the sky, no matter how much light you put around it. Of course, this assumes that all the light sources are kind of outside. In the realistic scenario, things are a little different because the light sources are usually, you have an accretion flow in here. But for our purposes to make the theorem and to calculate, we assume all the light sources to be kind of at infinity. Now, to do the calculations, I have to introduce a certain standard observer that allows us to derive a parametrization of the shadow. So the important thing here to remember is that, so basically E1 is roughly d theta, and E3 is roughly dr. And now we can compare this, so we can introduce a standard spherical coordinates on the celestial sphere of this observer, and then we can compare this to the coordinate derivative and use the geodesic equations to derive a parametrization of the celestial sphere in terms of conserved quantities. If we now plug in this parametrization the parametrization of the trapping, then what we get are the following parametrizations. So I will write down just roughly. So you have sine rho, sine psi is roughly is f of x, and sine, just because we need them, I need them later, just so you have that. So now we have the shadow parameterized in terms of the parameters of the black hole and this parameter x. Now it turns out what this parameter x is actually takes values between r min and r max of theta, which corresponds to the innermost radius of trapping and the outermost radius of trapping in that cone of theta. So these are, when we're at the point P, you can only, like the innermost trapped radius that you can asymptote to in the future is given by R min, and the outermost one is given by R max. And now this parameter X here that we have basically is given by the final radius where you will end up in the future. So you have from P, you send out your null geodesics, and the future trapped ones will end up on a sphere somewhere in between these two values, and that allows you to parameterize the shape of the shadow. Oops. Now, one important observation that you get straight from the equations is that the shadow for every observer in any point of a Kerr-Newman tau, not manifold, is going to be symmetric with respect to K1. So there's always a reflection symmetry with respect to the theta direction. And this is simply due to the fact, to the form of the equation. So we have theta dot squared is equal to the angular potential. So you always have, if one direction in theta is a future trapped one, then so it's going to be the reflected one. So you, even though you're not at the point of symmetry of the manifold, the shadow will still have this symmetric form. And similar, we have a symmetry between the future and the past trapped set if we reflect with respect to the radial direction. So if we analyze the shape of the shadow, we can either analyze the future trapped or the past trapped set. They're going to be equivalent from the information content. Now, a little more into the mathematical side. This parametrization here, what I forgot to mention, was derived by Grenzebach, Pellig, and Lemmertal in 2014. We did a small extension where we actually showed that this parametrization really gives you a smooth curve for every observer. And secondly, what is important, what I will come back to afterwards, is that if you're at the point of symmetry in your manifold, so if you can rotate the space-time and it's a symmetry, then the shadow is always going to be a perfect circle. And by circle, I mean the section of the sphere with the plane. So an actual circle, not just topologically. So this is quite important for the concept of degeneracies I will introduce in a moment. Now, here you can basically see the future and the past trapped set for Schwarzschild when you're outside of the photon sphere. Then you have the future trapped one. Future trapped set is on the ingoing hemisphere. The past trapped one is in the outgoing hemisphere. When we're on the photon sphere, the two coincide. So the future trapped ones are also past trapped. So they are actually trapped. And when we're inside, then we have again, now the future trapped ones are on the outgoing hemisphere and the past trapped ones are in the ingoing hemisphere. Now for Kerr, the whole thing looks similar, but now there is no one radius where we have a complete overlap, but there is kind of like, this is at the boundary of the area of trapping, this is somewhere in the middle, and that's when we're on the inner boundary. So we have again kind of like, when you move from outside of the area of trapping, then you have the two circles, the two trapped sets are separated on either hemisphere, and when you move through the trapped set, they kind of push through each other. And so at every point, you have kind of two actually trapped directions only. Now, a little bit more into the mathematical direction, what you can do with it. The notion of the celestial sphere gives you a coordinate independent formulation, what it means for trapping to be unstable. Namely, when you look on the celestial sphere, any open ball you take there will both intersect the future and the past outfall. The future outgoing set and the future infalling set. So if you have a trapped direction, there's always a way to perturb it such that you will end up either at the horizon or at infinity. Now, what you can use this, so you can also use the celestial sphere basically to show that trapping in that sense is a very generic concept. So as soon as you have a black hole, there will be future and past trapped directions. And basically any path that goes on the celestial sphere from the future outgoing set to the future ingoing set has to intersect this trapped set. So this is kind of goes into the more mathematical directions, which I'm currently still looking at, where we might want to actually apply this mechanism. Now this is just a little off track to the more mathematical stuff. Now, let's get to the question of degeneracies. Now, what I used to derive the parametrization of the shadow is I fixed one observer. Now, what happens when we change the observer at a certain point? Now, it turns out if we change the observer and we look at the shape of the shadow on the celestial sphere, the Lorentz transformation applied to the observer corresponds to a conformal transformation on the celestial sphere. And upon the conformal transformations on the celestial sphere, eventually, if we use the stereographic projection, will correspond to a Möbius transformation. Now, that is a lot altogether, so step by step. Now, we take an observer and we apply certain different Lorentz transformations to it. So if we rotate it, basically what happens is just the celestial spheres will be rotated. If we apply a boost in a certain direction, then you have the flow on the celestial spheres given by this vector field. So if we boost towards the center of the black hole, then the shadow will kind of be shrunk together, and if we boost away from it, it will be blown up. And then, so you can look at all different things, and so every Lorentz transformation kind of corresponds to a certain flow on the celestial sphere that is, so you, yeah. Now, this is the stereographic projection we use. You see here the parametrization functions show up, but basically all you have to think of is we take our celestial sphere and we project it into the complex plane, where the black ring here, the unit circle, is just given by the K3 equals 0 ring. So now we are, when we are doing our proof, we will be arguing in the complex plane, so in R2. Now, there was in 2015 another paper by Grenzenbach where he just looked at the deformation induced by various boosts. So this is basically here, he boosts in the theta direction. And so you see the location and the shape of the shadow changes. Here he boosts in the phi direction. And this is what happens when you boost in the radial direction. So as I said, like if you boost towards the black hole, then the shadow will become smaller. If we boost away from it, it will become bigger. Now, so the point is we have two mechanisms that change the shape of the shadow. One is a change of parameters. The other one is a change of observers. And now the question is, can these two effects cancel each other? And the answer is, yes, they can. Namely, in the case of an observer at a point of symmetry, this is very obvious. This is very straightforward. Since every observer at a point of symmetry sees a perfect circle, then we know that Möbius transformations map circles to circles. So basically, if you're at a point of symmetry, you can't say anything about, you can't extract any information because you're degenerate to any other point of symmetry. Now, a little bit, so basically we call two points degenerate if upon identification of the celestial sphere, there, there exists an element of the conformal group that maps the two shadow curves to each other. So what is important to remark here is what we do is we compare structures on the celestial sphere. So we compare structures on S2, which means we can take observers in different spacetimes and compare their shadows with each other. So we don't care whether P1, P2 live in different manifolds, different positions, anything. We can still compare the shape of their shadows. And basically, so what it implies for two points to be degenerate, that is, if two points are degenerate, like for example in Schwarzschild, any point, it's whether you're close to the black hole or far away and boosted, you will see exactly the same thing. So you cannot distinguish these two scenarios. So you cannot say whether you're here with that velocity or you're further out and having a different velocity. Now, the thing is, to investigate this problem, we have to linearize. So we now take a conformal transformation and we linearize it to first order. So we look at the Lie group of the Möbius transformations, and in a similar fashion, we linearize about the perturbation induced by a change in parameters. And so what we get is this variation vector for the curve. So the question is, we change the parameters infinitesimally, so we get a variation vector for the curve, or if we apply an infinitesimal Möbius transformation, we get a chain variation vector. So basically what we have is that for every point on the curve, we have two vectors, which is the one from the Möbius transformations and the deformation vector induced by the change in parameters. Now, here we have the normal vector, and the condition for a continuous degeneracy to exist now is that the deformation vector, this generalized deformation vector, is tangential to the curve. So basically, that is summarized here. So the variation orthogonal to the curve has to vanish. That means if we have a degeneracy, then the change that we get is just a reparametrization of our curve. So now in the menu, when we go through the whole procedure, we first look for the intrinsic degeneracies. So we ignore the Möbius transformations that we have at hand, because it's easier. We just look, okay, can we change our parameters in a way such that it's just a reparametrization of the curve? So we ignore the Möbius transformation and we just set this condition to be zero. And this corresponds in terms of the these functions here. This corresponds basically to this expression here. Now, the thing is, if we include the Möbius transformations, we need to make use of the structure of our curve. Now, as I said, if two points are degenerate, then between any two observer, there exists a conformal transformation. Now, the thing is, we know that the shadow for every standard observer is reflection symmetric. So, since they have to map to each other, we can only use those Möbius transformations that maps reflection symmetric curves to reflection symmetric curves. And this basically restricts our degree of freedom to only three possible Möbius transformations. And they are essentially, I mean, this is just translations, this is the zoom, and so this is kind of like just the scaling, and then there's this third conformal vector field. Now, a general linear combination of these, this is the most general deformation vector field that we get. And if we solve for gamma and beta, we get this ugly expression, but it's actually not too bad because you see, these two terms are identical and these two terms are identical, but these have a different sign. So since we know that beta and gamma are constants, we know that alpha has to be zero because otherwise they cannot identically be constants. And so more or less the expression we have here is almost identical to the one we had before. Now, an important point is, what does it mean for parameters to be non-degenerate? So when we say that something is non-degenerate, we always talk within a certain subset or within a certain set of parameters. So we cannot answer things in general. We can only say, with respect to the parameters that we probe, there is no further degeneracy. So that is an important thing to keep in mind when I say it's non-degenerate. It's always with respect to the parameter that we included in our analysis. Now, this brings me basically to the theorem we have, and that is that in Kern-Newman type knots, there are only two continuous degeneracies. So the first one is kind of the obvious one. That's just the mass scaling. So if you scale everything in your manifold, then nothing changes. So what this is saying basically is that only dimensionless quantities can influence the shape of the shadow. Now the second one is somewhat more interesting, as it includes the parameter L, And there's no such straightforward interpretation as of the first one here. So it's just the fact this one comes up, so we get a second continuous degeneracy. And what is important, I mean, if we set L equal to zero and we fix some values, there will always be a combination of the actual black hole parameters with L not equal to zero that still satisfies this condition. So if we measure something that is compatible with L equals zero, it will always also be compatible with L not equals zero. Of course, the other way around, if we measure C2 to be bigger than one, then we know immediately that L has to be a non-zero value. But so that is what I meant with we cannot, from an observation of the shadow, you cannot exclude the tau not parameter because simply it induces a degeneracy. And we have been doing preliminary calculations with including the cosmological constant, and the picture seems to remain the same. So we also do get a degeneracy from the L parameter, but this one we haven't managed quite to integrate it anymore, because what you get actually from the condition is you get an ODE that you have to solve to get the actual degeneracy. And for the lambda not equals zero case, this ODE is not quite so straightforward solvable. But it seems to be really that it's the L parameter that does induce the degeneracy. So like adding lambda to it, so the cosmological constant, seems like there is no further degeneracy. But we couldn't quite rule this out because the calculations get all more messy. Now, one thing that I've so far swept under the rug was the fact that, of course, what I discussed here is always continuous degeneracy. So I was assuming we have a whole curve of degeneracies in our manifold so that we can actually linearize. Now, there is one obvious discrete degeneracy in these spacetimes that you can just read off. And basically, it's like this change of parameters for Kerr. This corresponds to a flip with respect to the equatorial plane. So basically what it's saying in Kerr, from an observation of the shadow, you cannot really say in which direction the black hole is rotating with respect to you. So, I mean, or like if you're above or below the equatorial plane, it gives you the same information. Now, our friend Bob was a little quicker and assembled all the black holes in the neighborhood. And so now, thanks to our result, he could actually figure out which one of them was the bad guy and lock him up. Now, one thing, of course, that we have to discuss is, so we now showed that in principle, there's all this information in the shadow. And the question is whether you can actually access it. Now, there are a couple proposals out. There is this one by Rezzola and collaborators, where they propose essentially doing an expansion in Legendre polynomials. So they take the center of gravity of the shape, and they place a circle with equal area over top of it, and then they just measure the deviation of the curve to this comparison circle. Now, the problem here is that it's not really, this procedure is not really invariant on the Möbius transformations, where a second method comes into play that might be more interesting, as it's kind of based on all these conformal methods, that is this 2D shape analysis that was originally brought up by Feisler and Mumford, and generalized later by Yao and collaborators. So I've only recently come across this, so I haven't quite understood whether actually what they get out. So they, for any shape, they can get out some signature, and they claim that there's some Möbius invariance in it, but I can't quite say at the current point whether it is or not. Because of course, if we'd have a analysis tool that would kind of get rid of all the Möbius transformations, so that it would be insensitive to it, then we would immediately eliminate any degree of freedom that comes from our respective velocity. So we wouldn't have to assume, make any assumptions on how we are actually moving in the manifold. Now, a second, I said, okay, well, in principle, there is a change induced in the shape by a change in parameter. Now, I plotted here two shadows that are like a factor 10 in radius apart in a very, very highly rotating black hole in the equatorial plane. And now you can see yourself that the actual change in the shape is very, very tiny. So, yeah, so this is like if you compare an observer sitting at 5m and one sitting at 50m, that's basically all the change you get. So it's very meniscal. So now this basically brings me to the final conclusions. So what we showed was that in principle, you could observe almost all physical parameters of a Kerr-Newman black hole. But what I just showed in the last one, the resolution that would really be needed to extract these parameters is very, very, very sensitive. So it will, in reality, probably be difficult to be obtained. And the third point is, of course, as I already mentioned at some point, we assume background light sources, which is not quite the case in real-life observations. So there will be additional difficulties to deal with there. And yeah, as I mentioned, there we have preliminary calculations for Kerr-Newman de Sitter, which it looks like in principle one could extract the cosmological constant as well. But there, of course, even stronger, it's in real life, it's so small that the deviations will probably be very meniscal. Now, on the mathematical side, the one problem that remains is to exclude further discrete degeneracies, which I assume that except for discrete manifold symmetries, they shouldn't exist, but well, we haven't proven it yet. And last but not least, what I think would be actually of practical interest is if one can find a characterization for the shape of a curve that is invariant under Möbius transformations. If that can be done, that would be actually interesting because that would eliminate any degree of freedom from the image analysis. So that would eliminate how fast, so then you'd have to use one parameter less, or you'd have to fit one thing less to your observer, which should certainly be of practical interest. Yes, thank you for your attention. Yeah, so I mean, what it would affect is if we'd happen to be boosted, if we'd happen to be moving towards a black hole or away from it, then that would change the apparent size of it dramatically. But so to first approximation, I think we can reasonably assume that we're stationary with respect to the radial distance. So this shouldn't be affecting it in practice.
Observation is positive. Is the curve Schwarzschild description of the size is unique. I mean, you can measure it to within. The gravity theory tells you the size uniquely.
Yeah, the angular width. Yeah. For a stationary observer.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's exactly the point. If the observer is boosted towards the black hole or away from it, that changes dramatically.
The prediction of the size is intrinsic in a way. when you do the measurement, you take into account what you're saying.
No, I think it's usually just ignored. You just assume that you're not moving in radial direction, which I think is reasonable to a very high degree, yeah. Right?
So I guess to me, that pick up on this, there doesn't seem to me that there's a significant implication of the work you've done with respect to the observations that are expected from the
event. That's right.
Of the what?
The Event Horizon Telescope.
Yeah. No. I mean, it's more what we're actually claiming. What we're saying is that in principle, if you can get a perfect resolution,
yeah.
You could tell much more about the black hole than just the rough size.
Okay.
From it. That is the.
I think there is a lot of value in just trying to categorize how well you can extract information about the structure of the space-time from observations at large distances, right? And so certainly there are presumably difficulties in studying the region inside the photon orbit if all you ever had were photons that were coming in from infinity, going out to infinity, and then that's where you measure them, right? And so this is certainly a good first step along that path. I mean, the idea that you'd have to exquisitely measure the shape of the shadow. I mean, I think that we had pretty good clues that this was the case just by looking at how much you have to change spin by before you get something that's going to be practically different. But one of the things that gives me a lot of optimism here is that we don't just measure the shape of the shadow, where that is a smoking gun striking signature. Of the existence of a photon orbit, right? We also see dynamics. We'll see time delays. We'll see evolving structures, and we have a mission, like you said, that's down there. That's a complication in some cases. In other cases, it's an opportunity because you do get emission within the photon orbit.
Yeah,
kinds of accretion flows are relevant. So what are the prospects for addressing this information question in this much more complicated and broader context? How many decades will you need?
for the observations to get really to the detailed level, or for the calculations to get to the detailed level?
The observations are going to be detailed pretty quick.
But understanding the answer is what the general, so how the ellipses from pure information you get from this side kind of overlap or not? Are they aligned with the ones you get from complementary information?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Maybe with whatever you can do here, I mean, you need to compare.
Yeah, you will have like the change in emission intensity with respect to the two sides, right? I guess that will be much easier accessible measurement to the rotation of the black hole. While the change of the shape of the shadow will be minuscule, like already a small rotation will give you quite a strong change of brightness with respect to the side that comes towards you and where it goes away from you. So I guess, I guess one could kind of try to do this complementary. I mean, the question is, of course, always as well that, I mean, I've only started like looking into it, how sharp will actually be the boundary of the shadow, because, I mean, as we see in here, I mean, the change in parameters gives you something very small. So if you have already just a small bandwidth where you can determine the shadow, then this will give you a pretty large parameter space where your possible shadow could be it. So that is also one thing that I've been wondering about, how good this could be actually classified.
This is a particular case that is a bit too, I mean, you're too optimistic or too pessimistic. In reality, you're not at 5 or 50 m, and you have a good good idea of how far things are.
Yeah, yeah.
So if I change other parameters,
yeah.
How sensitive is the shape? That's what it was.
Well, the only parameter I think that it is reasonably sensible to really is the rotation, is the spin. I mean, the spin in as soon as you get somewhere above 0.85 or so, starts really to affect. So if you're also below that, it's going to be almost circular.
And even then, just in the equatorial plane, I mean, even if you spin it all the way up to one and you look at a larger oblique angles, then it's...
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what I said. In Kerr, of course, if you're on the rotation axis, this is a point of symmetry, so the shadow is going to be a perfect circle, and you kind of like transition to it.
So you're looking primarily at the shape of the circle, whereas they were suggesting that intensity is perhaps the most useful measure.
Yeah, I mean, you
would have a long list of such things.
Yeah. I mean, you'd probably. I mean, the realistic thing gives you some like emission thing here, roughly very weak here, and then kind of you get the. Something like that is what the actual thing looks like, right? And you'd have mostly this. So the difference between emission that is from the co-rotating side and here, I think that is what you're really going to see. So, I mean, this is just a rough.
The other issue is how accurately you can measure the angular radius.
Yeah, well, that's an SNR question at some level as well. So practically, the resolution of the EHT is going to put a handful of pixels across the diameter of the image. Okay, so it depends on exactly how you want to characterize the beam size, but something like 5. Okay? but now wait a minute. This is the classic undergrad lab example of how well do you know the mean of the Gaussian, right? Way better than the width of the Gaussian. And so even though we have 5 pixels, which is dictated by the size of the Earth, we can go back again and again and again and build up signal-to-noise ratio. And that means that we can figure out where the ridge line is much more accurately than you can find, much more accurately than 1 pixel size. So we can, I think 10% is a number that we talk about today for two reasons. First, because the expected size is uncertain to 10% just because of spin. If you don't have a prior unspin, between 1 and 0, 10%. Second, the size because we don't know the distance and the mass. This actually starts perfectly. It's around 10%-ish. So, you know, it doesn't make a lot of sense to push those things much beyond that just because you don't know what you're comparing to better than that. Yeah, I think without too much effort, we can get down to 5% accuracy estimates.
Of the shape or the size?
The size. We assume it's a circle. We just put a circle to the...
Yeah, fair enough.
You were saying something.
One last question from my side was, all of the studies that I've seen of this have assumed that we have 4 intervals of motion, so then that's very convenient for lots of reasons. What happens to the shadows if we give that up?
Well, I mean, there are these studies of what the shadow of hairy black holes look like. Mm-hmm. Have you seen those?
I've made some of those.
Yeah, okay. I mean, that's basically what happens. But for this analysis, it's difficult because we need the parameterization to say something. I mean, one could try. I mean, the problem with the degeneracy statement, of course, is that you can always only disprove a degeneracy numerically, that you can show that it doesn't match, but you can never prove a degeneracy numerically because the degeneracy, either it exists or not, so it's a zero deviation, which of course you can't really check numerically. But I mean, of course, you could change the notion to practically degenerate, so that means anything that you cannot distinguish, and then I guess you could also look at numerical things and be like, okay, how much does it have to change that you get at least X% or like I mean, that would be interesting to figure out a measure on the deviation of the shape that would actually tell you whether it's observationally distinguishable or not. So that you can work with it numerically, that you can check, okay, everything that's within that is non-distinguishable, everything that's outside would actually be, you could tell apart.
So what was you giving up?
Well, if your photon trajectories became chaotic.
So they're not null shifted.
You're giving up type D, basically.
Not null shifted.
They are null shifted. Not in the type D space.
Yeah, you're giving up type D. Because then you don't have this separation of the geodesic. Then you can't derive this parametrization of the shadow, the analytic, and then you can't do the whole game that we played here. Oh yeah, that's what I forgot to mention. Basically, I mean this parametrization exists for the entire Plebansky-Demyansky class. So basically, the procedure that we did here could be carried out for those as well. And it would be interesting to see there, particularly whether we see again, kind of like the unphysical parameters give a degeneracy and the physical ones not. That would be a nice thing. But that is open to be done. Yeah. Yeah.
What, how this degeneracy analysis is sensitive to non-zero accelerations? Because I understand that like all degeneracy issue comes from like local Lorentz transformations, but like in practice, yeah. If we like run Earth around sound or whatever, like we have like non-zero accelerations. To what extent, like this?
So you mean
observation?
So with acceleration, you mean the acceleration parameter in the Plebansky-Demyansky class?
You have this like local Lorentz transformations of tetrads, and like and like the question is like when we do acceleration, like non-inertial frame of observation,
Well, I mean, the point is we're always looking, I mean, this the whole thing we're doing here are snapshot analysis, right? So what we look at is we look at an observer at a point. So we're looking at a particular tangent vector, not really at the change of it.
Yeah, so, what is the stability behavior of this like degeneracy? Yeah, because like I mean naturally this is like a point like thing, but like the observational relevance of it would be like contained in the stability behavior of the solution.
Well, I mean it. So obviously, kind of like the shape would be changing continuously under change in parameters. So anyway, whether you're moving geodesically or not, also if you're moving geodesically and changing the parameters of observation, then the shape would be changing continuously. And the same is, of course, then like, I mean, if you add an acceleration, it's also you observe, you would have a continuous change in the field. So you'd be somewhere close by. So changing. So if you observe for a finite time whether this is an accelerated trajectory or not, it would be close by to the one at the initial point, I guess. I mean,
I would say like what is the intention of this question too? Like, and apart from just mathematical curiosity, like if I would be like trying to get any observations that would be like doable and like going along those lines, I probably would like try to compare like winter and summer seasonal measurements with like different, you know, like acceleration vectors of with respect to like whatever would be like the intended source.
Well, but I mean, that's difficult to do, right? Because you need to observe basically when all the telescopes are pointing at the same time or in the night sky and pointing towards SGA star, no? So they need to measure all simultaneously, all in the night sky. So you can't. So there's one window per year, more or less.
They don't. It's not even the night sky. It's also just matters of the weather has to be good everywhere.
Yeah.
And the weather is not seasonally good enough for millimeter astronomy everywhere at the same time. And so there are narrow windows.
Yeah.
So we do it in April.
So. Yeah.
So what about this boosted speed or velocity of the observer, right? So do you expect, so let's say if the boost speed is V, do you expect V over C change of the shadow shape?
Well, I mean, it depends in which direction you boost, how the shadow changes. So if you boost towards the black hole, there's a different effect than when you boost kind of like in a phi direction. So if you boost in rotation direction of the black hole, the shadow doesn't change that much. If you boost towards or away from the black hole, then what is affected really is the apparent size. And that can have a quite dramatic effect in change of size.
Well, the speed, with respect to Sagittarius A star, is quite small, so I would imagine that's...
I mean, that's what I said before. I mean, like, yeah, the apparent size could be affected by a boost, but I think it is reasonable to assume that for all practical purposes, we don't move in radial direction with respect to SJA star. I mean, that's what I would be, or that's what I think was generally assumed, and I think it is to a very good approximation, a fair assumption.
So you're really only looking at relativistic effects.
Yes.
You start doing
yes.
this.
Yeah.
We're not going to have relativistic observatories.
Yeah. I mean, this is really an analysis kind of like the question we're asking is really what is the fundamental limit the equations tell you, and then what is the practically application? What can you actually extract? That's a whole different question. That's a whole different story. Yes.
The Earth is not moving it. The speed of light.
Well, it's a good thing.
Well, relative to whom, right? Relative to the cosmic rays, it certainly is. Relative to the center of the galaxy, we know that the out-of-plane velocity of Sag A star is, now it's got to be less than 5 kilometers per second. Okay. So if you figure that's, I mean, it's hard to figure out the in-plane because we're moving at 220, but 5 kilometers per second, if you figure that's going to be comparable to the radial velocity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not radius. Our radial velocity, our motion within the galaxy is not relativistic. If it wasn't, we wouldn't be around for very long.
No.
Yeah, it would be, we'd fly off.
Yeah.
Pretty quickly.
Okay.
Yes.
With that thought, let's thank Claudia again.